Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I want to spend a few minutes talking about a story, an issue that has been creating some significant controversy these past few days. Well, more than past few days, but it has flared up in the past few days because of a story that we'll be talking about. It involves the graves that we've all heard about found at residential schools over the past year or so. So the story, as I mentioned, well, it was on the front page of the National Post the other day. The headline is "The Year of the Graves, How the World's Media Got It Wrong on Residential School Graves." And then the subhead says, "The coverage triggered protests, church arsons, and condemnation from Canada's bad faith rivals. But last summer's reporting on the country's long acknowledged historic shame had little to do with what happened." Well, as I say, for reasons that you can probably imagine, this is creating a bit of a furor. So I wanted to bring on the man who wrote this and is behind this and has looked into this. Let me read you his Twitter handle, because that pretty much covers all of what he, or many of the things he does. Author, journalist, Ottawa citizen, and National Post columnist, contributing editor for Maclean's magazine, senior fellow at the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights. His name is Terry Glavin. He joins us now. Terry, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that hesitating you're welcome, because I suspect that I could guess why. It's been a lot of people have had a lot of comments about this, but let's get to why they have. So for over a year now, we have heard about the graves that were discovered at these residential schools, starting in Kamloops and then at others across this country. What if we got it wrong, as the headline and as the story says, what do we have wrong about the story?
Well, it's easier to talk about what we got right.
Okay, really?
I mean, if you want me to, I will talk about what we got wrong, but it's just quite a bit. And I would caution readers to understand that I am not challenging the legacy of the Indian residential school system in this country. I have argued that that system was cultural genocide. I don't hold any heterodox views about residential schools. In fact, what I wrote was not about residential schools. What I wrote about was a kind of a national psychotic episode that this country went through last summer, and what prompted it and how it was sustained. And it involves a series of stories that begins with a story that is typified by a New York Times headline, "Mass Grave Found in Canada." There was no mass grave found in Kamloops. The Kamloops people, the chief, Roseanne Casimir, wonderful woman, did not claim to have found a mass grave. And it trundled along, you know, the terminology was changed to unmarked graves. It trundled along throughout the year until at the end of the summer, there were 1,300 graves that were allegedly discovered at the sites of old residential schools. And when you add them up, what you find is that that actually did not happen. After, for instance, Kamloops, we have Cowessess in the Marievo Residential School in Saskatchewan, and the local people, including the local chief, quite clear that this is not a residential school graveyard. This is a Catholic cemetery. The graves were unmarked because some of the graves lost their headstones back in the 60s or 70s. Everybody knew the graves were there. It's not like anything was discovered. The local Indigenous people never claimed that any graves from any residential school children's graves were discovered. At St. Eugene's, the Tanaha community there. Massive headlines around the world, Guardian, New York Times, everywhere. What was it in that case? I think it was 251 unmarked graves discovered at an Indian residential school. They were not discovered. It was not graves at an Indian residential school. The local chief, okay, Chief Joseph Pierre, tried to set the story straight. He said, this is actually a cemetery that was set aside for white people in 1865. There was a residential school here for a while. There was a hospital here for a while. We're all Catholics up here. There's Indigenous, non-Indigenous people in that cemetery. we get grass fires from time to time. The crosses burn. That's why the graves were unmarked. There was no discovery of a whole bunch of bodies or graves or whatever burials at an Indian residential school. This is, again, the local indigenous people, the local indigenous chief saying that. Then we have this announcement from the Penelicut tribe that 160-plus graves were found at the site of the or on the grounds of the Cooper Island Residential School. The Penelicut tribe never made any kind of announcement of the sort. Several days earlier, they had mentioned in a memo that they sent, the chief sent to neighboring tribes, that they were having a memorial walk for residential school children who were lost in the system, mentioned that there were 160 burials that had been encountered by ground-penetrating radar that had not been excavated in the tribal territory and on the foreshore. It's an island in the Strait of Georgia, the Salish Sea. And there was no indication that these were recent discoveries or recent findings at all. So when you add it all up, it comes to 1,300. None of these sites actually match what was said about these alleged discoveries.
But Terry, does
the same thing in Nova Scotia? I could go on.
But does everybody see? And it's really complicated because if you were to talk to most people, they would say, well, you're wrong. They're right that we did find indigenous burial sites. And so I'm like, you've done the research on this.
Not a matter of
opinion. Okay.
I kept my opinions out of it.
Mostly, so how did we get it so wrong?
I have a lot of opinions about how the media got it wrong and why. But I just related some facts to you. Okay.
Right. And so how did they get it? So how did the people covering it then get it so wrong? Because it would seem that this would not be difficult to establish if that was all true.
Well, the first thing you have to do is you actually have to pay attention to what real indigenous people are saying. I cover mainly foreign affairs and, international human rights and the eclipse of democracy around the world. And I've spent time in northern Syria and, Hong Kong. Of course, I can't go there anymore. And that's, but I have spent a lot of time covering these issues. I co-authored a book with the survivors of St. Mary's Indian Residential School. My first book was about indigenous peoples, the Gixan, and their struggles, their land struggles. My second book was about the Haniquedin, the Chilcotin. I've worked quite a bit in what we used to call Indian country. And I will answer your question by saying, as I've always noticed, journalists don't talk to the indigenous people involved, and they don't pay attention to what the actual local indigenous people are saying. And that's, I think, where things went wrong. And in each of these cases, the indigenous people have tried to correct the public record. But who, I don't know. I mean, you tell me, who wants to be the indigenous leader who puts up his hand and says, all this actually didn't happen. And by the way, this is not to challenge the overwhelming consensus that the residential schools were places of horror and agony, that this was cultural genocide. I didn't write really about residential schools at all. I wrote about a strange phenomenon that has been developing over the past few years throughout the Anglosphere, mainly in North America, the collapse of news organizations, the proliferation of digital kind of news simulacrums that are funded by Moscow and Beijing. The Americans are familiar with this, the RT News interferences that produced or helped produce the Trump victory.
Mm. And one of the things, Terry, let me just jump in because we're very short on time, but one of the things that when you first came on and I said, thanks for doing this, and you halted a bit, I'm guessing that's because as you look online as a result of this, you have been accused of a lot of things, residential school denialism, which you've clearly said you're
racist,
not.
Defender of child rapists and the whole thing.
And so why, if what you're saying, and again, for people who want to know about this, it's a fascinating story. They can find it at National Post. On National Post, they can look it up. It's a long read, but it's a fascinating read. Your story would seem to be the kind of thing that you, people could go and look up themselves and see if you're telling the truth or not. Why are you getting such blowback as opposed to people just going and doing their own research and finding out?
Well, I think part of it is that there are certain academic reputations that rest on a certain way. You know what it is? It's about the conflation of knowledge and belief. You know, there's what we know and what we're told or expected to believe. But I think a lot of people have been taken in by the proposition that to simply notice that, you know, the story got the last year's Graves issue really, really badly wrong is somehow engaging in what has been come to be called residential schools denialism. I don't, I am on the same page as Murray Sinclair, anybody else who has analyzed and looked at the system. It's just these, this event last year, I don't think it really had much to do. It could have been anything. The government wanted a George Floyd moment. And I think perhaps the Liberal government, was a bit self-interested in wanting to draw people's attention away from the fact that for 5 years, they had sat on the recommendations from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission with respect to these grave sites and the missing children and had done nothing. And so it was much easier for Justin Trudeau to take a knee again. And I hate to be cynical about this.
Well, that's the photo. That's the photo that goes with the piece. And Terry, look, I wish we could talk about this for an hour. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I really appreciate it. Terry Glavin is the author, The Year of the Graves. Go look it up. It's a long read, but it is worth your time. And then you decide to take, you decide if what Terry has written is credentialed and done right. And Terry, listen, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk about this today.
Man.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring you in to speak a little bit of politics this day. Stephen LeDrew, former president of the Liberal Party of Canada, now the man behind the 3-minute interview you can find on YouTube and on his website. Sir, how are you this evening?
I am very well, Scott, but I'm not a sir. But it's very kind of you in any event.
Well, you know what? Whichever you like, Sir, Stephen, either one will work. Listen, we are a day and a half now, basically away from the election, and I got to tell you, I've not seen any polls. Maybe there's one out there, and if there is, I apologize for missing it. But I have not seen any polls that don't show the Conservatives winning at this point, whether it's minority, majority, whatever. And yet, Stephen, almost every social media thing I see, most articles I read, most commentators I listen to, all tell me what a horrible, horrible leader Doug Ford is and how if we vote elect Doug Ford, the province is going to crumble and on and on and on. How is Doug Ford ahead when presumably every single person who has a social media account hates him?
Well, I think a lot of that, though, is the problem we have throughout this country, particularly Ontario, with a lot of media, Scott, which is either paid by the Justin Trudeau Liberals out of Ottawa, or is just blatantly, quote, progressive, end of quote, in any event, and it's the elites. And they don't like Ford. And you know, most people are just saying, you know what, it's been a tough time, he hasn't done a bad job, and then when you look at the alternative, Scott, you have two people out there, two pipsqueaks, and all they're saying is, elect me, and I will give you more money. I will hire more nurses. I will hire more doctors. I will build more hospitals. I will not build transportation. I will give you buck a ride. I will give you all these things. And I think most people are just tired of that old style of politics. It's just, you know, vote for me because I'm going to give you more. And most people realize that's total baloney. It's not possible. And if the governments, the elect, do that, their children and grandchildren are going to have to pay the money. Money doesn't grow on trees. And so I think most people are not enthused about this government, but it has done a pretty good job through some very tough times. And the alternatives are dismal. The Liberals are absolutely hopeless. And the NDP, well, they say is vote for us, we're going to print money. So it hasn't been an election which has attracted a lot of attention. No one's very enthusiastic about it. It's a matter of just sort of holding your nose and plowing through it and governing on. And I think that most people say, well, you know, we're just going to vote for Ford. As I said, we're not enthusiastic, but those other two parties, they're pathetic.
So if this is, from what I'm hearing from you, this is less about Doug Ford, this is more a referendum on Stephen Del Duca and Andrea Horvath. Do you believe either or both are still the leader of their party on Friday morning?
Well, this is Andrea. I know Andrea. Well, I know them both. I know Andrea. She's a lovely woman. This is her fourth election. I think it's highly unlikely that she will even want to stay on for a fifth. And it's not her fault. I mean, the party, there's some very good and decent people in the NDP party, but for the most part, they're concerned about, the billionaires in Venezuela and all kinds of other issues that just have no impact upon most Ontarians. So it's the party. As for the Liberals, Del Duca took on a party that was just in its death throes, and he has done, a workmanlike job. Is he dull? Absolutely. Does he have any new ideas? None. He may be given another chance. Depends. First of all, though, Scott, he has to win his own riding. As most people don't know, he has not been in the legislature. He is not a sitting MPP. So he has to win his own riding, and that's not a given. So he has to win his own riding. He has to win a whole bunch more seats than they have now in their minivan. And I don't know if that's going to happen.
One of the things, it's been a theory of mine for a while now, and, you know, like everyone has theories, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong. I've believed for a long time now, going back probably 20 years, that what has driven most election results has not been the popularity of the leader. It's been anger at whoever's in power. That got rid of Stephen Harper, that got rid of Kathleen Wynne, that got rid of George Bush, that got rid of Barack Obama, that got rid of Donald Trump. You get mad enough at the person who's there, you hate them enough, that motivates you to rise up en masse and go and vote them out. And as I said off the top, it seems like there are plenty of people who feel that same way about Doug Ford. So if we're to believe the polls, why is that anger not translating into any kind of results so far?
Well, Scott, you just said there seems that there are plenty of people who are angry at Ford. And I hear you. I understand that. And I agree with you. It does seem like there are plenty of people who are angry at Ford. But those aren't the people who are out there voting. Those are the people in the Toronto Star editorial boards. Those are the people in other fancy media offices who are, you know, lefty progressives. And they don't like Ford. And part of it is just personality. Part of it is their, you know, I don't know, maybe the way that they've been led around for the last 40 or 50 years and saying, well, we like these lefties because they give us a lot of money. And the media, by and large, does get a lot of money from some governments. And they like it. They, you know, this is a great game for them. So are they angry with Ford because they think he's not doing a good job? No, not in your life. They're angry with Ford because he is not on their side all the time, even though he gave a big, huge gambling concession to the Toronto Star, because most people don't like the Star. They don't read it. And the Toronto Star was going to go belly up, and he saved their goose. Instead, today, they are saying, you know what, do anything. Elect all these, quote, progressives so we can have governments that make more money and give us more money than Ford did. He didn't give them enough.
So is this then the literal description of the silent majority that we hear about all the time?
I think so. I think, you know, we're starting a summer. You know, we've had a few, you know, weeks of good weather after a miserable two and a half years for Ontarians. It's been awful. Between, you know, the health officials and people saying this, and then the day after they say the opposite, and between, you know, the Justin Trudeau progressives, you know, completely screwing up, in my view, what they've done with COVID, and you know what they're doing now with travel. Even the Globe and Mail has an article in the last few days saying that the Trudeau government is incompetent with passports, with airports. One person said in the Globe said they're like a bunch of drunken idiots at the wheel. So, you know, people are there's a lot of anger out there, and there's also a lot of desire, I think, just to get ahead and let's just move on. And the anger is not at Ford. There's anger at Trudeau. There's anger at his incompetent ministers. But there's, you know, you look at the Ford ministers, and he's had some pretty good people doing a pretty good job. You may not like the whole thing, but then again, I say, you look at the NDP and you look at the Liberals and look what they're promising, which is just spend, spend, spend. And people say, hey, you know what? You can't fool me again. I'm not going to go for you guys. And you know, I live in a part of Ontario that has been devastated the last 2 weeks by the storm and by hydro. And some people are saying, wait, no, wait a second. Hydro, the transmission of hydro, that was sold by Wynn Liberals to her Liberal friends. And there's been conversations about that. Oh, we are going to vote them back in.
People do have memories. It is that could well have something to do with it. Stephen Ledru, you can go find him at the 3-minute interview. Look at his website. Stephen, always appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Always a pleasure with you, Scott. Thanks a lot.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.